Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This is one of our most requested episodes that we're about to do. I'm really glad we're getting to it, but here is the incident. Overnight on January 23rd, 1961, in eastern North Carolina, a U.S. Air Force bomber broke in half mid-air. The crew of eight were ordered to abandon the aircraft. Five of them would survive this incident. The plane broke up, came crashing down in a fairly populous area near Goldsboro, North Carolina. Now, what was aboard that aircraft that broke in half and came crashing down over eastern North Carolina? Two MK-39 thermonuclear bombs. These hydrogen bombs were being transported by the airplane, and of course, they too came crashing to the ground as well. While being transported, the nuclear weapons were unarmed, but the investigation in the wake of this crash revealed that as they came crashing to the ground, the bombs had gone through several steps of the arming process, and one of them in particular was basically one signal away from detonation. So let's talk about the time in 1961 that the U.S. nearly nuclear bombed itself over in North Carolina. Here to do that, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
I have to calm myself down from the anxiety attack I'm having just from the description of this. It's too much.
It's quite remarkable.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
Hello. All right. So a quick show of hands among the three of us. Just, is anyone here married to a former transport pilot for the Air Force? Let me see. Okay. Oh, okay. Kelly, you're raising your hands.
Y'all have me, like, I have gone down a rabbit hole with my husband because I should just say, my husband went to the Air Force Academy. He majored in aeronautical engineering. He is currently a pilot. He's been a pilot for, gosh, over, I don't know, 20-something years. He also did his master's thesis in anti-ballistic missile something. Like, he's, sometimes I look at him like, who are you? You know when you find out you're, like, married to a spy and you're like, who are you? Like, so I asked him if he knew about this crash in North Carolina, and he was like, oh yeah, everybody knows about that. And I was like, really? Everybody knows about that? But apparently, what's even scarier is that this is actually not an anomaly, that they have had lots of crashes, like dozens upon dozens of crashes that have just kind of gone, like, at least under the public radar. And it's astonishing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think the larger context, of course, in the 50s and 60s is the U.S. is just, like, very quickly getting into nuclear weapons and obviously transporting this and running experiments and maybe not realizing what it has gotten itself into. Thoughts on that, Nick Geer? Do you want to just talk about the sort of incident here, and then we can contextualize about how rare or scary or whatever it actually was?
I just think it's really important to understand that the fact that we made it through the 1950s and 1960s without nuking ourselves is kind of a miracle. If you look at how precarious this all was and how, you know, everyone's just kind of experimenting and trying new ways to cart around nuclear weapons, and they decide they want to do it while carting around nuclear weapons. That they're like, oh, let's try this. Let's get those bombs up on the plane and fly around and see what happens. Seems like a really bad idea, but they were doing it all the time. That something like this not only happened, but happened on the regular, it is a miracle we're all still here.
And I should say, like, part of the context Nathaniel, that's my husband, Nathaniel was giving me was that the capacity was just so crazy. Like, now there's, like, maybe, like, 100 or so, like, bomber jets in the Air Force, but back then there was, like, over 500. So they were constantly flying all over the place, and they were always armed. Now they don't do, you know, they don't have nuclear weapons on these planes when they're practicing, I should say. But when they were practicing, all of them were armed, and they were all over the world, all of the poles. It was meant to, like, they were, like, circling the poles. These airplanes would circle so that if at any minute something went down, especially during the Cold War, they could get to Russia relatively quickly.
Right. And so this airplane in 1961, called the Keep 19, which was a Boeing B-52 G-95BW, only Kelly's husband will appreciate that, but nonetheless, a Boeing B-52 G-95BW Stratofortress with a with a, oh my gosh, with the 424 First Strategic Wing. That was a unit. Anyway, I've seen this reported as a training mission. I've seen this reported, but it is really on an alert mission, and it is off the coast of the Atlantic coast of the United States with these bombs. But basically, because the U.S. is on sort of continual high alert, both doing training missions, but also wants to be in a position to react should there be a nuclear strike. This is the height of the Cold War, of course. And so the notion of a surprise nuclear attack by Russia is not totally out of the question. These bombs, these Mark 39 nuclear bombs, are about 12 feet long. They weigh more than 6,200 pounds. The energy is 3.8 million tons of TNT is the equivalent. We'll talk a little bit about what would have gone wrong had these actually detonated, but maybe a little TikTok on the incident itself. It's during refueling that something goes wrong. There's a fuel leak and the plane starts to break up. I mentioned in the intro, there's an alert to eject and the crew tries to eject. What else goes down as we know it?
Well, so I think, so you mentioned that it's refueling, and Kelly was talking about how these planes were always in the air. So this was one of those 24-hour surveillance alert flights. Mm-hmm. It's flying up and down the coast. It's going around Greenland, coming back. And it's somewhere in that refueling around Greenland that something happens. They notice that there's fuel coming out of this plane. And so it's trying to do an emergency landing in North Carolina at a nearby Air Force base when it just starts falling apart in the middle of the air, right? It a wing falls off, and so it starts barrel rolling, and then the tail falls off. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the people inside, there were eight people on the crew, they eject. And because the plane like cracks in half, it pulls the pulleys that you would pull if you were releasing the bomb. And so the bombs think that they're being launched, not just falling. And these two bombs fall to earth as they're going through their arming sequences, and one of them gets stuck in a tree, as you do, and the other one, they lose the other one. The other one sinks into the mud, and they don't know where it is.
To this day. Which to this to day. They don't know where it is.
Terrifying.
Yeah, yeah. I should also say that it does take a lot to set off a nuclear bomb. It's not one of those bombs that will implode upon impact. It's like it's more constructed like a clock, so it requires a certain fuse to detonate it, and there are certain steps that have to go in place. A lot of them, I believe, my husband told me, not one person can just set it off. Like, it takes multiple people in order to like relinquish an H-bomb. So, I mean, that should give us some comfort knowing that it's not just going to like hit the ground and implode. But at the same time, the chemicals that are, you know, involved in these bombs are super toxic. So, you know, there's always the fear of that, the plutonium that's in all of them, you know, it's a lot. But I think that the interesting thing about this is that the United States was more concerned that the bomb dropped in U.S. territory than anything else. Because if it drops in North Carolina, well, then, okay, we don't have to worry about the Soviets, like, coming to get it. But if it drops in the ocean, then it's, like, all bets are off. And that's where you get the film, like, Men of Honor, where they're, like, submarine is going down to retrieve the bomb or whatever.
Right.
That's where that comes from. So location really does matter.
My main concern would have been the nuclear bombs landing just, you know, a couple dozen miles east of Raleigh, North Carolina. That is my main concern. But, you know, I understand the point you're trying to make.
And as comforting as it is to know that there are all of those steps, they barely hold. I mean, not only do these bombs go through their sequencing, but the final step, there's a kind of a toggle on the bomb that's either on safe or it's on arm. And on one of the bombs, for some reason, it was switched to arm, and it was just like two wires didn't cross, and so it doesn't explode. But the knife's edge on which this unfolds, and the difference between what happened, which is essentially nothing happened, and this bomb that has a 17-mile kill radius, like it would have just wiped out anyone who was outside in a 17-mile radius, to prevent that from happening, I mean, it just a wire.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
And there's a lot of, you know, details about what exactly went wrong and still some sort of speculation about what it was. I mean, but basically, you know, and as we said, you know, one of them, a parachute deployed and it landed in a tree. Another one just hit the ground directly. And that sort of may have been the thing that switched it to arm. But a P-51 piece of wiring may have popped off and so forth. Anyway, there's a lot of sort of small little knife's edge moments here, which sort of reminds me of a point we've talked about on the show in general, which is, you know, there's one way to view of American history is us just kind of like bouncing back and forth between near disaster, occasionally tipping over into actual disaster. But it feels like so many of the stories we discuss are just like, wow, you know, just think about what could have happened here. Yeah. Do we want to get into that a little bit? You just sort of mentioned it, but, you know, a 17-mile blast radius, again, fairly populous part of the country. And what is the what if here?
Well, the big what if here is this is in 1961. John Kennedy has just been sworn in as president. The Cold War is as hot as it's ever been because of what's going on in Cuba. This is going to be the site of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs disaster. Like, Kennedy has inherited a mess, but it's also one of those moments in a transition of power where you could imagine the Soviets trying to take advantage of this young new president. And so had this bomb landed and gone off, not only would it have been devastating for the people that it killed, the environmental cost, but the U.S. would not have necessarily known that it had bombed itself. It could have interpreted it as an attack from the Soviet Union, and there you go. Then the bombs start flying, and it becomes a catastrophic, if not apocalyptic, disaster.
This is also what, I mean, we refer to as the military-industrial complex, which is the rapid, rapid development of military technology and bombs and missiles. I mean, we get annoyed at how much the iPhone changes, but the way that, like, these planes and these bombs and these missiles are being constantly upgraded, constantly magnified to, you know, create just incredible amounts of harm. It's extraordinary. I mean, when you think about the fact that they usually, I mean, after when they start sort of rolling back the number of planes that they're using because they realize they can use missiles or basically rockets, like, those missiles can get from the U.S. to the Soviet in 12 minutes. 12 minutes. That's if they're in the United States. So imagine if they're on some submarine off the coastline. It's a matter of seconds that they can detonate. And so it should give a lot of people pause about, well, is this necessary? Is this, like, should we be doing this? I mean, there's a lot of ethical questions that have to go into play when thinking about these, not just potential disasters, but, like, why are we even doing this?
Major accidents involving a nuclear weapon are called broken arrow. That's where that term comes from. The Defense Department has disclosed 32 broken arrow incidents between 1950 and 1980. Now, you know, there's a little skepticism.
That's what they
Those
disclosed.
Are the ones they disclosed. Exactly. You know, 21 of these declassified ones have been aircraft-related incidents. But Kelly, to your point, there's all sorts of other incidents that have gone on as well. This is a chance for me to shout out an amazing Radio Diaries piece. It's one of my favorite radio pieces of all time. Our friends here at Radiotopia, Radio Diaries, did this fantastic piece about an incident in 1980 where a worker at a missile silo in Arkansas dropped a wrench, and the wrench then ended up piercing part of the silo, and it set off an explosion, and it was, again, right on a knife's edge of basically wiping out much of the Midwest of this country. I mean, just, you know, catastrophic. This incident we're talking about here in 1961 would have basically killed everyone within a 17-mile radius. This other incident, this in 1980, could have been even worse, but, you know, these were happening fairly often, and so it's worth paying attention on that front. As we wrap up, there's one I've known about this for a while, and I think I've, like, kind of ended up randomly on the Wikipedia page for the Goldsboro incident a number of times. There is a road sign, a marker for this incident, but if you look at the sign, and we'll post this on Twitter or whatever, because it's like this small sign by the side of the road, and it says nuclear mishap. B-52 transporting two nuclear bombs crashed January 1961. Widespread disaster averted. Three crewmen died. And that's it. That's the sign. And it's just like, you know, we talk all this time about, like, well, there should be a plaque about this. It's like, well, sometimes the plaque doesn't really tell the story. This feels like this little sign right here on the side of the road in North
that
Carolina.
That you're going to drive by.
Doesn't really seem to paint the picture. And it makes me think also of an email we got As I said, a number of people have recommended this. We got an email from a listener named Sam Taylor who grew up in this area. And he says that he often thinks about this event because his father, who would have been seven around the time, recalls that his grandparents took him and his siblings to see this crash and the unexploded nuclear bombs. And he said that the cars in the neighborhood were backed up for miles to try and drive by and get an eye on the crash site. And he says, you know, that these bombs were about 250 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And thousands of people, including his family, would have been, you know, wiped out or at least faced years of radiation poisoning had they actually gone off. But there's a sort of listener who has a sort of first person account of what it must have been like to have this happen in your community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that combination of both just perilous disaster and interest. Like, if there's an unexploded nuclear bomb hanging from a tree, there is a part of you that kind of wants to go see what it's like.
Up in the car. That's
right. Yeah. Not me. Again, I go back to the ethical questions, right? Like, is this necessary? Like, I mean, overkill, I think, is like an understatement. This is like all that goes into this technology. I mean, it begs a lot of questions. A lot of questions.
Yeah. You know, certainly in North Carolina, this part of North Carolina, this is a known incident. There is the small little, there's the stories, and then there's the small little plaque. This incident was generally, I think, hidden or not really covered until, you know, maybe 10 years ago or so. And I think a lot of that is due to Eric Schlosser, fantastic historian and writer who wrote about this in his book, Command and Control. But that wasn't until 2013 or so.
Yeah, and it was made possible by the release of a tranche of documents about this, right? He spent so much time putting in FOIA requests and trying to get this information from the government and the military. So it took a lot of legwork just to get the information of what really happened.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that is a good way to wrap up the episode. I think we've learned a lot. I think that they should make that plaque a little bigger.
Yeah, a little more information.
Say more. But yeah, this is super fascinating. And yeah, I went and we checked. I think this is six times we've gotten emails from folks over the last couple of years saying, hey, we should do this. So I'm glad we finally got around to this one. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you. And thanks to your connections to a U.S. Air Force expert.
Thanks to Nate. My pleasure.
Radiotopia.